People walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders. And he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. This is the word of the Lord, and we believe it. Something struck me in the last couple of days. I suppose it's always kind of been in the back of my mind. she's not in here, so I can say this. But I have a daughter who turns 13 tomorrow, and she will tell you that it's tomorrow. She's been telling us for the last about month that she's one day closer. Her mother and I are desperately trying to pump the brakes on the march of time. But the thing that struck me about it, and this is the thing that I don't want to think too much about, but there are some estimates that Mary, the mother of Jesus, could have been as young as 13. Let that sink in for a second. Now, granted, kids grow up differently in different parts of the world under different circumstances. I get all of that. But wow, that's an amazing thing. And then the faith that Mary had to say, let it be to me as you have said. I don't understand that kind of faith. And I'm so grateful for it. But yeah. Anyway, this is the Advent season where we mark time, and we're doing so by examining the throne names of the Messiah. You might remember that kings were often given throne names when they achieved certain things, and what we find here in Isaiah are throne names given to the Messiah prophetically before he even walked the earth. And yet when we look at the life of Jesus and the things that he did and the things that he brought to us, we see all of those throne names fulfilled. They were not done in vain. They were or arbitrarily, but they actually described his nature and his character. And it's been kind of fascinating to look at these in some more depth, because there are things, I notice this at Christmas time, maybe you do too, there are certain things that we just kind of accept by tradition, but when you dig a little bit deeper, it's like, oh, that actually means a little bit more than what I thought that meant. The one that, and I mentioned this one before, but I've always found it interesting that in the Christmas carols that we sing, we talk about angels singing, but the text doesn't say that angels sing. It says the angel said, which I thought was really an interesting thing. And I heard one pastor make the comment that there will be no singing in heaven until we arrive. Well, that's an interesting thought. I'm not sure that's something I want to dig too deeply into, but it's interesting to think about that there are things that are in the storyline that we hold by tradition that aren't necessarily in the story. Like there could have been more than three kings. I know, right? Three kings, and that's a really important one, right? But there may have been upwards of seven even by some accounts, some tradition. Anyway, but when we look at these throne names, when we see these things in Isaiah and we dig a little bit deeper, we realize that there's something a little more rich underneath the surface. And I don't know about you, but I've really enjoyed it because I want to get to know the Messiah more, in the sense that I want to understand his nature, I want to understand his character, because I think he's the same now as he was then. And of course, last time, or the first time that we started talking about this, we looked at the name Wonderful Counselor, and what we realized is that it's better to think of it as Wonder-Working Counselor. That's a better translation in my mind. And then, of course, Dan just read the verse that talked about he's the wonder worker. Yeah, that's kind of who he is. We talk about this signs and wonders, and And if you're a believer, you know, chasing after the presence of God, one of the things that you ought to expect at some point is displays of his power. Now, I don't know what those are going to be, but that is something that you should expect, that God is going to be God, and in his presence, he is going to manifest his power as well. He's the wonder-working counselor. That hasn't changed. And then last week, we talked about this idea of mighty God, and the word that's used here is a decidedly military term, that when we talk about mighty God, it isn't just mighty in his wonder-working, but he's mighty because he fights for us. How many of you are glad that you've got an all-powerful God who fights on your behalf? How many of you could use a little more of that right now? Yeah, right? That's true. But that's his character. That's his nature. That's not just something that he does. That's who he is, as he fights on the behalf of his people. And we see that, of course, throughout the entire Bible itself. Today, we're going to pick up this term, everlasting Father. And as you're going to see in just in a moment, the term is almost better, eternal Father. It's you'll see what I mean. But in Hebrew, the term is ad ab. Ad ab. Yeah, not odd as in weird. Ad, A-D-A-B. Ad ab. It's kind of funny, actually. And this idea of ad, A-D, ad, is we translate it as kind of everlasting, but it carries some extremes with it. And I want to try to explain this, because it's not necessarily mental gymnastics, but you got to think about it a little bit. So this notion of ad, this notion of everlasting, applies both to the future but also to the past. When we talk about extremes, right? So it's not only future-looking everlasting, but it's also backward-looking. It's really an interesting thought if you're going to put it on this spectrum, it means at the same time ancient and perpetual. I remember the first time I came in contact with the word, but I was visiting for a project. I was visiting a famous cemetery in Savannah, Georgia. It's called the Bonaventure Cemetery, and it's very Victorian, and it's actually a beautiful place. Lots of money spent on things like gravestones and family plots and whatnot. But there was this thing that was on some of them. It said in perpetuity. It means that there's care given to that particular plot in perpetuity, forever and ever. So perpetuity. So this idea of ad in Hebrew has that notion to it. Not only is it completely ancient, but it is also completely in perpetuity. So think about that if you're going to think in terms of a spectrum. And if I'm reading this correctly, at least so far from what I've been able to tell within the text, its use is only applied as an attribute of God. It's not something that you see by itself. It literally is one of those words that's only associated with the divine, at least as far as I can tell. And the implication that God exists outside of our understanding of time, because we tend to think in linear terms, and he exists outside of that. So he exists in Ancient of Days, but also eternally into the future, which is kind of mind-blowing. But that's supposed to be the case when we're talking about, you know, the all-powerful divine, right? And I think sometimes you can translate it as eternal, and that may make a little more sense, but everlasting fits too. Now, the other part of this name, I think, seems a little more straightforward. It's Ab, which means father. So let's leave the everlasting part behind for just a moment, and let's deal with this word father, which is Ab. Now, typically speaking, when we Westerners, especially American Westerners, when we think of father, we tend to think in terms of nuclear family, right? We tend to think of in terms of, you know, a traditional family would be mom, dad, kids, you know, kind of a thing. And that's kind of the building block. And so it is within the Bible itself. But this term Ab, this term father, actually has some dimension to it. Or maybe I could say it has a little more texture, in the sense that father, in this particular case, can refer to a little bit more. It has I guess I would call it a broader reach. So it can mean founder, it can mean head, it can even mean chief. And sometimes it's applied to the idea of the originator or a forefather. So it's not just a particular role within the family, a family system, but rather it's a descriptor of people who occupy that role. Okay, so you're going to have four fathers that would also be Ab, or chief. And we'll talk a little bit more about this as we go along. But as 21st century post-Enlightenment people, we tend, like I said, to think of time in a linear fashion. It has a beginning and an end. And yet this throne name, at least in my mind, implies that time itself didn't start with an event, but with a person. Because that person exists outside of time, and so our understanding of time comes from him, not from some event. Does this make sense? And I think for me, I mean, okay, we can have talks about that, and it could be all theoretical and whatnot, but I think for me what it does is it adds to the grandeur, the majesty, and the sheer mystery of God himself. He is the everlasting Father. He existed before time. He will continue to exist after my understanding of time. And all of it started with him. He's the everlasting Father. He's the forefather, the originator of all of those things. Which just implies that he's really, really big. And I think because he's that big and everything kind of starts with him, there are two things in my mind. One, he's worthy of my worship. And number two, he is to be feared. Now, don't get me wrong. I still think that there's this loving aspect. And I think that's why we use the term father. And we'll talk more about that in a second. And I believe all of that. And yet he's the one who comes down, wrapped himself in human flesh so that I can understand him. But the fundamental understanding of God is that he is to be feared and he is to be worshipped because he's just that big. He's just that wise. And he deserves all of that I give to him. And I think at Christmas time, we tend to focus on the baby, which is just fine. I mean, that's the way God intended it. But behind all of that is the everlasting Father, the one who is so big we can't even really comprehend it. God, I got quiet in here all of a sudden. So this term Ab is really, really kind of interesting. In Hebrew culture, this idea of Ab, just like I said, wasn't part of the nuclear family. But maybe you could think of it this way, is that when you think in the terms of father, as it's applied here, it really is about head of household. And it has, like I said, some implications to it. So for instance, it's built into the ancient legal code. Let me see if I can illustrate this way. So if a man has three sons, what would happen upon his passing is that the eldest, his estate would be divided among the three sons, but the eldest would always receive a double portion. Why? Because that eldest son would then become head of household, Ab, and would have to provide for everybody else in the household. So while every single one of the sons would receive something, the eldest would get a double portion. Now, here's the thing, and this is what we miss over and over. Yes, they get a double portion. Yay, you get more than your brothers. But you also got double the responsibility. you were supposed to take care of them too if they needed it. It's a big deal. And sometimes I think, and right now in this country, oh, here we go. In this country, what happens is we're really big on stamping our feet for our rights. But the problem is that for every right, there's a whole litany of responsibilities that go along with it. Interesting how we all want rights, but none of us really want the responsibilities. And you have to have both in order for the thing to hold together, to actually, you know, work. And so it is, even in the ancient legal code, is yes, the eldest brother gets the double portion, but also gets the bulk of the responsibilities for everybody else, including the family reputation, for that matter. So there's a lot more to it than just the transfer of wealth within a society. That's part of it. The term in Hebrew is betab. It means kind of the central house, and so the eldest brother would then have the betab. He would be considered the head of the family, the head of the overall household. He'd be responsible for any unmarried women. He'd be responsible for his brothers until they reached the age of majority, where then they could go out and work and establish their own homes. And so there's an awful lot of responsibility that's laid upon that eldest brother. And frankly, I think personally that this is what Jesus had in mind when he told his disciples something in John 14. And you don't have to turn there. Let me just read this to you because I find this fascinating. John 14, let me start with verse 1. Jesus is talking to his disciples and he says, "Do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God, trust also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you, I am going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am. You know the way to the place where I am going." I think this is what's going on here, is that we're talking about Jesus becoming that Ab. He is the eldest brother. He's going to create a place for the rest of his brothers. That's his role. That's his responsibility to them. Now, he also says in other places that all authority on heaven and earth have been given to him. So he gets all the rights, but he also has the responsibilities, and that includes you. You understand that? You get to be a part of that. So he goes to that place to create a space, a place for you as an individual. And I'm not talking about you collectively. I'm talking about you sitting in that seat right there as an individual. And I think that's an important thing for us to think about. He's preparing a place for his disciples. That's the role, the responsibility, and the privilege of the eldest brother. He's able to do that. The Ab had a significant and actually a heavy role in ancient Israel as well. There's responsibilities here. There's three that come to my mind. There may be more. I hold out for that, but there's three. And since we all want to go and have lunch at some point, I'll just stick it to three, okay? So there's three things that I think the Ab has a significant role in. First and foremost, the Ab's role is to protect. The father's role is to protect. And of course, this means, you know, physically, you know, definitely, there's a responsibility for the health and safety of his household. So, you know, they can't let the kids just run amok. They actually need some guidance and supervision so they don't go and hurt themselves. But also in the Old Testament, and this is where it gets a little uncomfortable, and you have to understand there's some cultural context here. There's some customs of the day. But the head of the household, too, was also the blood avenger. If something were to happen to a member of his household, like if somebody was murdered, for instance, it would be the head of the household's responsibility to go and get vengeance for that. Blood avenger. And there were rules all around it, and you know, there's very specific things that were laid out in the legal code, but that was the role of the head of the household, is that you know, you had to administer that kind of justice as well. And so that's part of the protection. There's also this notion, and you may have heard this, is the kinsman redeemer. And this is probably best illustrated in the story of Ruth in the Old Testament. But you had the Ab, the Betab, you have the head of the household who is financially responsible for not only the individuals in his household, but also their land. So what would happen is if you had a brother or a relative who had some land that they had to pledge and they lost it because the creditors came and took it or whatever the circumstances were, as the kinsman redeemer, it was my responsibility to go in and pay for that debt so that the land stays in the family. Why? Because the land was the inheritance from God. And to give that up would have been a great dishonor, not only to the individual, but to the family as well. So this notion of the kinsman redeemer had to protect the family financially as well as physically. If a family member needs financial assistance, there is biblical obligation to help. Biblical obligation to help family members who are in financial trouble. Now, here's the deal. Just on a practical note, you need to do your best to not enable foolishness, okay? And let's be honest, we all have a cousin or an uncle or somebody who doesn't know how to handle money. Do you know who? And if you don't know who it is in your family, guess what? Might be you. Just kidding. But the Bible is really clear is that we're to take care of our family members financially. Again, you don't want to enable the foolishness, but there is an obligation that we have to care to care for them. But here's the thing that you have to remember is that if you fulfill that obligation by taking care of the family member who's in financial trouble, the repayment of that money is not on the person that you gave it to. It's on God. Because you're following Him. And if you're going to assist a family member, don't expect repayment from them. That's something that God's going to do. And there's a whole series of Old Testament and New Testament verses that kind of support this, but I want you to think about that as you're going into this holiday season. And, you know, my hope is that you don't have to deal with any of those kinds of issues, but some of you will. And if you're going to be in a position and you prayerfully consider that maybe your responsibility as a family member is to support someone else, cool. But don't expect the repayment. That's on God. That's not on them. Which, you know, and I think you have to be careful when you lend money anyway, right? I think it was Dave Ramsey who said, if you take money from a family member, Thanksgiving dinner tastes different. And I get that. But there's an obligation within the scriptures that says that you need to take care of the people in your household. Who else is going to do it? Now, if God tells you something different, that's between you and God. The point is that there's a biblical understanding that as head of household, you take care of your family members, and that God will in turn assist you. And you have to have faith in that one. Repayment is on God, not on the one you give it to, and that really is faith. Secondly, protect. So we're going to protect. The second thing that the head of household, does is provide. Provides for the family members. We, you know, obviously touched on this already, but it the head of household meets the needs for food, clothing, shelter, and belonging. And I think this is sometimes where, all right, I'm going to speak to the dads for just a minute. Ladies, I'm coming for you later, so I'm just kidding. But guys, I want you to hear me, especially if you're head of household here, is that there's food, clothing, and shelter. And I think there's something ingrained in each one of us where we know this to be true. I want to make sure that there's decent, you know, groceries in the fridge. I want to make sure that there's, you know, a house in good repair, the roof doesn't leak and the heater works and all of that. And then, you know, they got to have clothes. And when you have girls, it's a whole different thing, because women's sizing makes no sense to me at all. I just, and most women I know say the same thing, but I'm like, I don't buy clothes anymore, because gift cards are a great invention, by the way. You know, I'm just saying, whew, yeah. But we understand this idea of food, clothing, shelter, but there is another piece to the puzzle, and dads, you need to hear this. It's belonging. Your kids and your wife need to know that they belong to you and your family. And I think we miss that sometimes. But that's just as much as of providing as all the physical stuff. Do your kids know that they belong to you? Not that you own them, but that you are proud of them and you are glad to be their dad. Do they know that? How about your wife? Does she know that you're still glad that you asked her to marry you and you're thrilled that she said yes? That ought to be something you think about, because that's belonging. And we want our families to actually belong. I didn't understand a lot of this when I was younger, but my wife did a marvelous job of trying to build traditions into our Christmas day. Now, all of us have those, right? But I was talking with our eldest daughter, Elizabeth, one day, and I don't even remember the conversation, but she started to talk about the various traditions that Mom created on Christmas Day, and I realized, that's belonging. Part of what she will remember, what my girls will remember about me and my wife, and what they'll tell their kids about are those types of things. That's belonging. Does this make sense? That's a big part of providing for your family. And I hope you have those traditions. If you don't, get started. It's not too late. Oh, and by the way, this idea of providing also includes hospitality towards others. There's a certain what they call desert laws of hospitality. And if you were trying to survive in the desert, you would provide hospitality to others, because at some point you may need someone else to provide hospitality to you. And so there's laws built into the legal structure of ancient Israel related to this. And I think there's a certain amount of truth to that, because God does not ask us all to do this life on our own. I'm all big on the American pull yourself up by your bootstraps, but that's not a biblical idea. I need you. You need me. We need each other in order to live this life. And so we sometimes have to sacrifice in those and provide for others in moments when they might need the assistance, because there is going to be a day when I'm going to need some assistance. And we need to be honest about that with ourselves and others. So hospitality, I think, is a part of providing. So protection, providing. Here's a third one. I'm not sure exactly how to put this. There's probably a better word for it, but it messed up my alliteration, and you know, it can't be Christian unless it all starts with the same letter. So anyway, so protection, providing. Then the third is to push for growth. And part of what we do is, as heads of household, and what I think God does, is push us to growth, to, you know, yeah, come as you are, but don't stay that way. You want to be on some type of trajectory towards, you know, growth or improvement at least. A good Ab sought to improve his family. And that would be their reputation and their financial condition, all of that. But to improve his family, to have the kids and members of the household be a part of things that they're proud of. There's nothing wrong with that. And in fact, I think that's all good. That head of household wanted and supported all his family to excel and succeed. And very often this would happen in a business setting. If we're understanding this biblically, it would be in kind of a business sense. It could be religious too, but business in particular. I heard a a Jewish rabbi outline the purpose of wealth. And you might want to write this down because I did, and I try to think about this. The purpose of wealth from this particular perspective. One is let's see if I get the wording right. Yeah, to build families. You need some wealth to build families. Now, of course, in Jewish culture, they have to go to a Jewish school, and so that's really expensive. But to educate the kids, that's a big part of it. But the idea of building a family is to create opportunities for future generations. That's the purpose of wealth. Second is to strengthen communities. Have you noticed that very often when there's a Jewish community, there happens to be a lot of wealth? There are reasons for that by how they interact with one another. And so the purpose of the wealth is also to build communities, not just build families, but to strengthen the community. And the third, as this rabbi put it, the purpose of wealth is to assist others in need. That's that provision piece. That's that hospitality piece. I think those are really helpful to think about. And we want to push for growth in such a way, not just financially, but financially can certainly be one of them, so that we can build families, strengthen communities, and assist others who might be in need. Knowing full well that someday I might need some assistance. But the whole point is that that's the purpose of this. And so we push our families to attempt to improve themselves in some way. And of course, this also can happen spiritually. There is something about watching your kids learn spiritual lessons earlier in life than what you learned them. There are some things that my girls have figured out that it took me decades to, and I'm so glad that they figured it out because they will be leaps and bounds ahead of me later on in life. That's pushing for improvement. That's pushing for growth. I want to see them grow and mature and develop, and I want to see their relationship with God. I hope that they have more a sense of the presence of God than I do. I hope for that, because I know that that in the long run is going to benefit them more than anything else that I could possibly give them. So protect, provide, and to push for growth. And what I find so powerful is when Jesus says this, and back again in John 14, here he says in verse 6, I want you to hear this. Jesus says, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you really knew me, you would know my Father as well. From now on, you do know him and have seen him. And I think what's so powerful about that is we have access to the Father of Fathers through Jesus. This struck me early this morning. I was thinking about this a little bit because the term for Father is Ab. It's actually kind of a technical term. But when Jesus talks to God, he calls him Abba, which is a familiar term. It would be equivalent to Papa or Daddy. How many of you with your kids, if they walked into the house and say, Father, it is good to see you today. Father, thank you for this meal. It's a little weird when they're formal, but when they're talking to their friends and saying, this is my father, or this is my dad, when they talk to me, it's Daddy or Papa or whatever the word is in your household. And I know some people spend some time thinking about what they're going to be called when they're grandparents, right? But those are familiar terms. And so instead of Ab being father, the term is Abba, which is familiar and softer than Ab. And so Jesus recognizes his heavenly Father as Ab, head of household, but also as familiar Abba, the one who loves me. It's very striking that those two words are so close together. And I think there's a reason for it. I think it developed because, you know, you can have somebody's dad, and anybody can be a dad, but not everybody's daddy, right? It's important. Now, one of the things I want to say before we leave this idea of Father is that when we use that word, for some people it might be uncomfortable because you don't have a good relationship with your Father. In fact, there are some of you who may have had one of those circumstances where you would never call him Dad or Daddy, you only called him Father because that was a kind of weird relationship you had, and you know it was weird. And you're uncomfortable with these terms. And there's a couple things I want to say to you. You didn't have a father who believed in you or supported you. And maybe even, and I don't even want to say this out loud, but maybe that father failed to protect you. Or even perpetrated the crimes. And for whatever reason, the holidays and terms like, you know, everlasting father really bother you because it reminds you of unhappiness. The first thing I want to say to you is, I'm sorry. It wasn't supposed to be that way. I'm sorry that your father, biological father, failed you. I'm so sorry for that. And I also recognize that there may be instances where there are fathers in the room who know that they have failed or feel like they have. I'm sorry. It's not too late. There is a God who is willing to help you mend relationships, and it may be long and it may be hard, but you're not without hope. And if you're uncomfortable with the term father, and you don't even really understand what that means, and referring to God, who's a loving God, as father really makes you uncomfortable, I'm going to offer you a suggestion. If it's hard to see God as a father, then simply regard him as king and start there. You see, he's both. If it's uncomfortable for him to be your father right now, then start by letting him be your king. And when you're in the presence of the king, he will teach you what father really means. It's in his presence that things change, when our relationship with him changes. But if you start with him as king, the father part will follow at some point. I don't know when. I don't get to decide that. He does. But you are never on shaky ground if you regard him as king and begin there. So I don't know what your family relationships are like. And you may not be able to change anything in your past, but you have today, and you have this Christmas season, and you have an understanding now of how to protect and how to provide and how to push for growth and do the things that a head of household does. And we've got a great guide in Jesus who fulfills all of those things perfectly every single time. And if you've lacked that type of figure in your life, that's okay. He's here for you too. And it's not just in the past, what we read in the Bible, it's not just for today, but it's also in the future, because he's looking to have an Abba relationship with you. One where you can have a talk. One of the things that I've really enjoyed is the kind of relationships that have developed in my household with my girls. Hard to say because I know one of them's listening right now. But I do. I love that relationship. I like having those conversations. All the things that I dreamed of. And I'm so glad that there was a God who loved me enough to help me get over myself and help me establish those kinds of relationships. Heavenly Father, you are good, you are kind, you are merciful, you're wise, and you love us. You loved us enough to send us your Son to endure things that were unspeakable so that we could have what was unfathomable. And as we go into this Christmas season where there is an emphasis on things like family, Lord, I just pray that you would teach us what your kind of family looks like. That we would lean into your protection, your provision, and even those gentle pushes that you give us to be better disciples, to be better human beings, to be more present with you and the people around us. God, I also recognize in the room that there are people who are uncomfortable with these terms, and I want to just pray that you would speak to them in the way that they would understand, in the way that would be most meaningful for them, because that's what you do. You'd speak to their heart in the way that they need the most, that you would do some healing work this holiday season, this week, this month. You would do that kind of work that only you can do. And that would start a new type of relationship. God, I just pray that we would collectively hear your voice, that we would recognize that these throne names are not simply descriptors about something that you've done, but they are your nature and your character, and you are inviting us into that type of relationship with you. And so as we come into this season, help us to be faithful to the things that we know and to learn new things as well about who you are and who you want us to be with you. I pray this all in Jesus' name. Everybody said.